This is The Topic is Trek, episode 155 for Friday, March 22nd, 2024. Coming up in this episode, have we got some deals for you? The latest in compact models, Vengeance is Nine, Deep Space Nine. All that and more right now on The Topic is Trek. The Battle for Paramount Mountain. Welcome to The Topic is Trek, the podcast that runs on impulse power. Join us for a journey where no show has gone before. If it has to do with Star Trek, there's a good chance we'll talk about it. Sooner or later, because on this show, The Topic is Trek. Engage already. Well, hello, everyone. I'm Clinton, and welcome to another thrill-packed edition of The Topic is Trek, the show where we talk about Trek. But in order to be a co-host, I must have other co-hosts with me. And so beaming in first from parts unknown to join us with the hip new catchphrase that maybe one or two people will be talking about in a week or so, I'm not sure, is Mr. Craig Stepp.
Screw you guys, I'm going home.
Now, was that a hip new catchphrase or are you just making a statement? I'm not sure.
A little bit of both.
I wouldn't mind. I'm not going to argue with him if he wants to go home.
I'm and taking my phaser and going home.
Through the miracle of advanced sound going through the transporter, also beaming into Genesis, Mr. Chuck Tomasi.
I cheated. I came in the side door.
You should go.
Yeah. That's right.
So I was going to ask if anything was up, but Chuck, you posted a picture today of something really cool that you had a chance to see. Now, was it your first time seeing this thing, or have you seen this thing before?
I have not seen it before IRL.
No. Okay.
Seen many, many documentaries and articles. I got to see the official Smithsonian Air and Space Museum Enterprise, all restored in its glory.
It's really cool, isn't it, to see it in person?
It is. And that wasn't on like our agenda when we originally laid this out. It started out as, hey, if the cherry blossoms are in bloom, let's just take a walk around to the various monuments, Jefferson and Korean War Memorial and Lincoln Memorial, etc. And we got done with that and said, now what? Oh, we got the afternoon and it's getting really windy and I don't want to be outside. It was nice weather and all, but we'd already walked about 10 miles.
Said, yeah, you can do that easily there.
Yeah. So we said, International Spy Museum, Air and Space Museum, and flipped the coin, said, let's go to the Air and Space Museum. I think we'll have a cooler time there. And then got done with that and said, we still have an hour and a half before dinner. So then we went to the Natural History Museum. So lots of good time in Washington, D.C. yesterday. And the cherry blossoms were early just for us. And the weather was nice just for us. It warmed up from like highs of 50s to highs of mid-60s. And then it went back. So sorry, everybody who missed it.
I'll tell you what, one of the, as a side note, one of the menus, one of the museums that I really enjoyed, I think it was like the natural history one was good. But I enjoyed the American history one. And they
there's a ton of museums in Washington, D.C.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you walk in, and at least at the time I went, the Michael Keaton's Batmobile was sitting right there. There's Superman's, their George Reeves Superman uniform. I mean, all kinds of stuff. It was cool. It was,
you could spend a couple of weeks just doing museums there. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just walking around the mall and catching all the stuff.
Absolutely.
All right, well, speaking about catching stuff, we hope we're going to catch Charlie on a good day, because now it's time to find out if we can start subspace chatter.
Does he have good days?
Well, let's see. Charlie, is it okay to start subspace chatter?
You don't need all that subspace chatter.
And not a good day. So maybe he was not really happy with the fact it was cold outside.
Weren't we going to use his AI-generated voice at some
point? Well, he's a work in progress. Well, Charlie's a work in progress, no matter how you slice it, I suppose. That's
true. I think he got stuck with the pay it forward in the Starbucks line this morning.
Yeah, I think so.
All right, good. So I won't ever do it again.
I will put up the first slide here, and then, Craig, if you can assist me with the second two. Sure. But if you hear this in time and you have the cash to spare, you might want to head over to the Heritage Auction for the Greg, I think it's Gene Hollywood Entertainment Auction. Because there are some interesting items up for bid, such as the teacher from Spock's brain.
Oh, wait, wait, pause there. When they did Spock's brain on the Star Trek cruise, they used one of those like tan plastic covers that you use for the dinners when they bring it out of the kitchen. Yes. Mm-hmm. You have the plate and then you have that brownish, almost cylindrical tapered. Yeah, that was their teacher. Taped to a mic stand. So well, this is much more authentic.
Next year they can do a repeat and have the actual item.
That's right.
Or a pair of Leonard Nimoy's Spock boots.
Were they cleaned?
No, look, they look disgusting.
Well, worth more if they're dirty. You know, yeah. Long story involved with that. And the art director's model for V'ger. You can also pick that up. You can even bid on what's left of those flying blob parasite things.
The fried eggs. The fried eggs.
Operation Annihilate.
Cool.
Keep them away from Sam Kirk.
These really don't look that healthy anymore.
Well, considering the fact that they're over 50 years old,
true.
And they were meant to be used in a show one time.
We also saw Spock's ears, or at least some of Spock's ears.
Yeah. You know, it'd be funny if you pick this up thinking it's going to be floppy and it's like solid.
Crisp.
Yeah, it snaps off little pieces of it.
It's more like peanut brittle at this point.
So the auction is Friday, March 29th. 2024, obviously, and we have a link to the auction as well as links to a few of the items we found interesting in the show notes for The Battle for Paramount Mountain over at thetopicistrek.com. All right. You can take it away.
All right. So the next Star Trek streaming series is right around the corner if you walk really, really slowly. And here's why. If all goes well,
yes.
Do you want me to read the quotes?
Yes.
Oh, yes. No, the big quotes, big quotes.
The big quotes, like where somebody's talking for a while, not names.
I don't mean to say Star Trek, Starfleet Academy.
But. Hey, wait a minute.
Craig took the instructions
meeting,
a little
did
too.
Did I not say anything in quotes?
You took it a little too literally, Craig.
I just asked her.
Okay. I'm going to use air quotes.
Clinton, we need to dumb it down again.
Yeah. All right, so if all goes well, Star Trek Starfleet Academy. will begin filming in late summer of this year. But when you tack on 6 months of shooting and another 6 to 8 months of editing and effects work and overdubbing like we're doing here, we're demonstrating.
And you see what we have to work with?
Yeah. It was likely we won't see our first group of cadets until 2026.
They'll be graduated by then.
You know, they have to get new shirts that say class of 2026.
We'll see the graduation ceremony.
Yeah. On the bright side, though, speaking of a correspondent from Collider at South by Southwest, executive producer Alex Kurtzman did offer a bit of insight into the premise of the series. He said, it will find cadets asking the same type of questions young people would ask today. Questions about inheriting the mistakes of the past generations and wondering how they can be fixed and how can they build optimistic future that Gene Roddenberry envisioned. Maybe not Gene Roddenberry by name, but.
It was interesting that last picture, Tilly is literally holding a grudge.
Yes.
So Kurtzman also tried to address any concerns longtime fans may have had by saying,
we have to make sure that we are also pleasing people who have been around and are diehard TOS fans, diehard Next Gen fans, or whatever iteration of Trek is yours. We cannot alienate those people. We actually also have to invite them to the tent. So the challenge is, how do we do that while also bringing Trek to a new generation of fans that have never watched those shows? So we need to make a show that you can drop into if you don't know anything about Star Trek, but also a show that you can get a tremendous amount out of if you have all of that canonical history.
So as soon as we have more information on Starfleet Academy, we'll let you know. And you know where we're going to let you know?
Where?
At the topic is Trek.
Ding.
.com. There you go.
All right. Advance to the next slide, and I'll have you assist me there, Craig. So if it looks like the Netflix series Black Mirror may help us reach peak Inception levels of Star Trek. As you may know, back in 2017, season 4 of Black Mirror featured an episode entitled USS Callister.
Yes.
Without getting into the details, the story centered on a crazed software genius, Robert Daly, and the Tron-like device he used to enter virtual reality. The cyber world he created was heavily inspired by the look and feel of Star Trek. The episode itself won 4 Emmy Awards and was directed by Toby Haynes, who was so much of a Trek fan, he practically begged to helm the episode. Jumping forward a bit, Toby Haynes will now be tasked with directing one of the Star Trek movies currently in development. Mind-blowing stuff. But we're not done yet. In a recent teaser trailer for season 7 of Black Mirror, we briefly see the symbol of the USS Callister, with accompanying text saying, 6 new stories, but one looks a little familiar. Netflix went on to clarify things a bit, saying they added Robert Daly is dead, but for the crew of the USS Callister, their problems are just beginning. So is someone about to wipe the computer system and delete the Callister? Are they about to meet Khan, Noonien, and Singh in virtual reality?
Moriarty.
And just as important, will Toby Haynes be going to be behind the cameras for both this episode and the next Star Trek movie? We're not sure. We want to find out. But season 7 of Black Mirror premieres on Netflix in 2025.
That's around the corner before the next corner for the other one.
Yes. Lots of corners to get around here this time around.
That's right.
We're cutting corners, fortunately.
Right. We cut all the corners. Well, we just talked about the virtual reality version of the USS Enterprise. Now let's check out a few real life versions. Sorry. First up, a YouTuber who goes by the name of Real Coldfinger, quote unquote, uploaded a short video showing off their brand of glass top coffee tables. Nothing too unusual here, except that underneath the glass is a highly detailed 1/6 scale of the TOS Enterprise bridge, complete with working lights and sound and whatever that rotating Maori pattern thing is that Star Trek, that Spock was staring at on the science station. Now, the miniature bridge is created by Jeff and Kim McClevey, who run the online store 3DTrekker.com. It is not a standard item in their catalog of the Trek reproductions. Well, at least not yet, but when you look at it, you'll be like, wow, I wish I could buy that. So we can't say how much it is. A Real Goldfinger created that table that surrounds the model, stating that the top tempered glass panel by itself is 200 pounds, which is pretty hefty. One YouTuber wins our best award post by stating that this is obviously not a coffee table. It's a bridge table. Anyway, we have a video link to the video in our show notes, as well as one of the shows off the model and lights and turned on and off, and the show notes for the Battle of Paramount Mountain over at thetopicistrek.com.
I was just going to add,
it is impressive. If you do anything, go look at it. Watch that video.
It is. And, they just delivered the actual model. So with the end of the bridge set is, that's what they delivered. I said, they just delivered that. I mean, but that's what they delivered.
To your house?
And so he built the frame to put around the whole thing, which was quite a task as well.
Just but the glass top is 200 pounds.
Yeah, yeah. So you,
that's a lot.
You're not putting that on the second floor if you're not really sure about the structure of your of your house, I don't think.
Hmm. Well, you don't have to worry about the cat jumping on top of it and crushing the bridge.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
I wonder if you can set it up to, like, just start up in the morning when you, you know, come into the room, turn on the lights, and just comes to life.
Just the sound, the bridge atmospheric sounds are playing. Yeah, there you go.
So let me advance the slide here to get it ready for you, Craig. On the other end of the spectrum, in their
I'm still having a battle in my living room.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. Settle down, people.
That's the security system going on.
Too much coffee on that coffee table. All right. On the other end of the spectrum is a project being run by Mr. Trek, not to be confused with Larry Nemechek, aka Dr. Trek. On his YouTube channel, Mr. Trek recently gave everyone an update on his TOS Enterprise model. His 40-foot long Enterprise model with a detailed interior.
It's one half scale.
Right.
All right. He has been working on the project for a year now and projects it will take him at least another 4 years to complete it. In the video, Mr. Trek shows off test builds of many of the interior spaces, including a briefing room complete with table and chairs, a superstructure of decks 6 and 7 in the saucer section, crew quarters, and main engineering, all in 1/25th scale. He also showed off a test redesign of the hangar deck in 1/100th scale, where we see the bay itself, storage and maintenance areas, and the shuttle arrival reception area. It takes up all of the room of deck 19 and really brings the area alive. So that reception area, I guess, is where Amanda and, you know, Ambassador Sark came on board. The items are mostly built using cardstock and modeling clay. We have a link to the video, as well as one where Mr. Trek talks about the space needed to house the completed model in the show notes for The Battle for Paramount Mountain over at thetopicistrek.com.
Yeah, I need a hobby when I retire too, but I don't think I'll live long enough to finish something like that.
Yeah, I'm surprised at the rate at which he's getting stuff done on this, including the fact that I don't know if I'd have the patience to build out all these things in a scale that wasn't the scale I was going to do just to, you know, run it through and see how that's going to look. I said, no, it's going to be 1/100th scale now because I built some stuff in that scale. That's it.
That's his test bed. That way he can see what fits before he scales it up to 1/25th.
Wow. I think I've seen those pictures before. Those look pretty cool.
Wow. All right. With Picard already ended and Discovery ending this year, running a bit thin on new Trek. Of course, we have Starfleet Academy on the horizon. But what about things like the proposed Star Trek Legacy series? Well, seems it's all about timing. I would have said budget, but the article says timing. In an interview with Vulture, CBS CEO George Cheeks was asked directly about the fate of Legacy and the overall production pipeline for the Trek on Paramount Plus. Cheeks acknowledged that Trek is one of Paramount's most important franchises. But then he added,
"We don't want to offer up all these amazing premium drama series all at once. Luckily, we have this incredible partner in Alex Kurtzman, and we all work together to sort of manage long-range planning across many years. So, there's a lot we're focused on, but it should not suggest to you that there's a tremendous amount of focus and a scaling back."
Well done.
No, it's beautiful. "There is a tremendous amount of focus and prioritization of the Star Trek franchise.
Bottom line, don't give up on Captain Seven just yet."
Well, it's interesting. So he's basically saying that, I'm kind of going to go along with this, the fact that we don't want to get burnt out on it.
Yeah.
And plus, they also, you know, if you've got a bunch of series, if you dump them all at the same time, then you get somebody to subscribe for a year. And they get to see all of Lower Decks and all of Strange New Worlds and all of, you know.
And we'll have nothing in 3 years.
I think even stepping back a little bit, it's not just you get a dump of all the productions. I think if the problem is they want to stretch out the announcements of the productions. So them not talking about Legacy is telling me that Legacy is on its way.
And think of how much work we would have to do if they dumped all that content at once. Thank you.
Six shows to review in one episode.
We're going to have enough trouble next time because there's going to be two episodes that we just watched that day.
But I think you shouldn't kid yourself. I think that Legacy is on its way.
That's one of my predictions that we'd hear something. Now, with this long-term planning, that may not come true even if they've got it in the plans because they don't want to announce it yet. I don't know, but you kind of hope that really is the thinking there, that after you had that initial burst of so many different things going on, okay, now we need to step back a bit and dole things out a bit more slowly and, you know, as well as have other things on the platform that are now picking up some of the slack that when CBS All Access first launched, the name of the game was Trek. There really wasn't much else they could offer up as original programming.
Right.
And now that they have other stuff, they can have, let's ease off on the gas here a bit with these plans we have for things coming up. We'll see. All right. Let's move on because there's a never a dull moment when it comes to covering the potential sale of Paramount. So the latest wrinkle in the report is a report that private equity firm Apollo Global Management has made an $11 billion bid for Paramount's Hollywood studio. And this comes just as Paramount's board of directors are weighing a merger with Skydance Media. But the Apollo bid and the Skydance plan are not equals. First, Apollo's bid is only for Paramount Film and TV Studio and would not include CBS, Paramount Global's cable networks like BET, Comedy Central, Nickelodeon, and MTV, or the streaming business that includes Paramount Plus and Pluto TV. Skydance, on the other hand, is looking to take control of the entirety of Paramount Global. Second, Apollo's bid is one being made directly for the studio, while Skydance is taking a different route. Run by David Ellison, son of Oracle founder,
Larry Ellison.
Larry Ellison, thank you. Skydance reportedly wants to purchase National Amusements, the company that controls 77% of Paramount stock, then merge the entirety of Paramount Global with Skydance. National Amusements president Sherry Redstone is reportedly much more in favor of that plan, which will make the reunification that Paramount and Viacom complete a few years ago. That's not going to undo that by just selling off the studio and then doing this, that, and doing the other thing.
They'd be going backwards.
Exactly. But what's the big deal? Well, it all comes down to things like stock value and doing what is best for the shareholders. That's the job of the Paramount Global Board of Directors. And by the way, Sherry Redstone is the non-executive chair of the Paramount Global Board of Directors. If the sale of just Paramount Studios means the parts can be sold for more than the whole, it might be in the shareholders' best interest to split up the company. And with every passing day, investors are riding a roller coaster when it comes to Paramount stock. The trip has been mostly downhill, but there have been some spikes up on things like this Apollo offer. But if the decline happens, if the declines of the offers are too many times over again, then the spikes won't even happen. And Paramount closed today at $11.88 a share, down from the 52-week high of $23.33 a little less than a year ago.
Ouch.
Now, on the other hand, Apollo's offer could allow the board to seek a higher price for the company as a whole.
Yep. Mm-hmm. You got to be careful with this kind of things.
Yeah, it's a fine needle to thread on this one. It feels like this has been going on forever, but we really only started talking about this stuff the end of last year when those first rumors were floating around about Warner Brothers, mm-hmm. Warner Brothers Discovery having a conversation. So now we're going on 3 or 4 months of it now. You're hoping that we're getting, I've got a feeling that we're going to see the Skydance deal go through. But it will be a tough sell for the shareholders if somebody says, oh, well, if they're going to take the studios for $11 billion, we've already got an offer in for BET Network, and we could, you know, this and that, and then we get into the pieces again, just selling it off in pieces. And we're back where we started from with Paramount over here and CBS over there and
Viacom in the back lot.
Yeah. And so fingers crossed that it all works out, and hopefully soon. And I checked, it's still tumbleweeds over in Vulcan, Alberta, Canada, so we don't have anything new to talk about from them.
What, did they all leave?
Well, they're there. They're just kind of, you know, taking care of business and such, doing things and so forth. Yeah. I don't know exactly what they're doing, but we do have some links in our show notes, linked to 81 additional stories that are broken out by series, movies, and other categories. So you can get all sorts of things from Classic Trek all the way up to a lot of articles about Star Trek Discovery. Now, the first 4 episodes of Star Trek Discovery Season 5 have been put out for reviewers to take a look at. So I didn't read a lot of these articles that talk about those first 4 episodes because I'm trying to stay at least a little bit spoiler free.
Right.
On it. But if you want to go right ahead and read this stuff, just go to the show notes for the episode, The Battle for Paramount Mountain, over on thetopicistrek.com. And you can read all about it because we've got a lot.
I'm looking at number 79, which is timeless. William Shatner calls Star Trek V his biggest regret of his career.
Wow.
Shocking, but true.
Yeah.
Shocking but true.
Oh, we've got it all, everybody.
Hey, by the way, speaking of Star Trek V, I was listening to the Trek Files with Larry Nemechek.
That was the next thing on my playlist.
Yeah, and it talks about Star Trek V, and there were some things I did not realize about it, which I thought was interesting. So you'll enjoy that, Chuck.
Cybok was adopted?
Surprise. I'm kidding.
Cybok
was Amanda's biggest regret.
All right, now time for one of my favorite parts of the show, and that's where I get to say goodbye, Charlie.
I want to stay.
You can't.
Poor Charlie.
That's what he was quoted as saying when the bouncer was kicking him out.
Access denied.
All right, now it's time to head out on our main mission with an appropriate sound effect.
We got to follow that one up with this.
Unable to comply. Internal scanner relays have been damaged.
Uh-oh.
Yep.
Sure.
That's it.
We'll go with that.
And now it's time for our Reading Rainbow segment.
That's right. Where's LeVar when you need him? So our main mission today is going to be talking about, mostly Chuck is going to be talking about, the book that he read, which is Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Vengeance, which was first published on February 1st, 1998.
Hey, it's written by
David Abhue. David Abhue, born David Friedman, 1960, is an American science fiction author. In the 1980s, he served in the United States Navy, training to be a radar intercept officer, hoping to be selected to become an astronaut. He's most noted for writing fiction in media franchises, including several novels for the Star Trek franchise. He also wrote 4 novels associated with the game Doom, as well as unrelated science fiction, He has been nominated for both the Hugo Award and the Nebula Award.
Cool.
And Craig, right. Can you give us a short synopsis of the book?
Yeah. So rumors of a secret alliance between the Dominion and the Klingon Empire lure Captain Sisko and the crew of the Defiant on a desperate mission into the Gamma Quadrant, leaving Deep Space Nine vulnerable to a surprise sneak attack.
It's not a surprise if you put it on the back cover.
Don't!
As long as they don't read it first. Now, an elite Klingon task force has seized control of the station, and only Chief O'Brien. There's a T in there.
Yes, Chief O'Brien. I think that would have to cut and paste from.
Yeah. Not anymore. It's not.
And Dr. Bashir and Worf are left to defend Space Nine.
It's but not Worf's on the book. The T is not on the back cover. Okay, we're good.
But Worf's loyalties are tested when he discovers that the invaders include his oldest friend and his own brother.
Dun, dun, dun. Hey,
now, I want to take 1 second.
Yep, that's pretty much how it went.
Hey, before Chuck gets into it, on the cover of this, pull it back up for a second. Oh, the cover, okay. It looks like the Klingon said, O'Brien, my computer's not acting right. Can you take a look?
And O'Brien's thinking to himself, did you turn it on and off?
It's like he's helping him with a did computer you restart problem.
It? Did you turn it off and on again?
Yeah.
All right. And of course, as always, I have not read this book. I don't know what's in it. So I've just done up a couple of images of some characters and occasionally I'll put those in just to break things up. But I'm going to turn this over now to Chuck to tell us about Deep Space Nine Vengeance.
All right. Let me start with the setting. I believe it's somewhere in season 6 of DS9 because it's the Dominion War is happening. Kira is carrying Keiko's baby. Remember, she did that transplant thing for a while, and she's almost due. The station is nearly deserted. And Nog is at Starfleet, and Rom is an engineer. So we've got the time and space. Dax and Worf are seeing each other, but they haven't been married yet. And Odo is not a shapeshifter. So we're in that pretty specific window. Right? I just don't remember where that was. But that's where we are.
I think you're about right.
The scenes open up with Quark. He's kind of going crazy because he doesn't have any customers because the station is pretty much empty except for good old Morn. Wait, is this AI generated?
No, I drew these all by hand. What are you talking about?
These are frightening images. Listeners, you've got to watch this part. This is more entertaining than my review. Okay,
it looks like his mouth is.
Let me keep going because I got a lot of notes here. All right. Quark is actually wearing a light-up sandwich board, and he's walking around the promenade trying to draw up customers. And Odo comes along and says, "You know, I don't like it." Because Odo's also bored, so the best thing he has to do is harass Quark. Well, Quark, you know, obstinate, and he doesn't want Odo to push him around. He continues on, and as soon as Odo leaves, he takes it off because he doesn't like it either. He actually starts showing envy for Rom because Rom is busy and he's not. So speaking of Rom, Rom and O'Brien are working on something, you know, fixing whatever he's fixing. And Major Kira calls him up and summons them up to ops immediately. Actually summons O'Brien and he says, Rom, I need you to finish this up. And Rom is, oh boy, I get to, he's all excited because he's in charge of something. Up there, Sisko is playing a recording for them from Admiral Montgomery to the senior officers. In the message he plays is a term humints, as in humints. These aren't what you'd use for fresh breath. So Bashir says, excuse me, what is that? Well, it's a human intelligence unit. So they've been doing some intelligence on the Klingons and the Cardassians and et cetera. The war is not going well for them, and they discover there may be a new founder weapon. So O'Brien has been tinkering on getting the Defiant a cloaking device so that they can be a little more stealthy in their pursuits. Sisko asks Worf to have the Defiant ready just in case. We don't know just in case of what, but at that point, or shortly thereafter, the wormhole opens up. Two Klingon ships are pursuing a ship of unknown origin who's sending out a distress call. Help me, help me.
Sounds like the setup for my book.
Shh. Now I got to figure out how to go to the next page. There we go. Sorry, I'm reading my handwritten notes from several weeks ago. So if I pause, I either can't read my writing or I'm trying to interpret what I wrote. Okay, so yes. I apologize for that. Or so both. Cut to O'Brien.
Judge you harshly right now.
O'Brien, Dax, Sisko, and Worf, and two ensigns are being sent out on the Defiant. So he gets the Defiant out quickly. Dax does some scans. She notices there's a fourth blip momentarily, but then dismisses it. Ding, ding, ding. Plot point.
That looks exactly like it, by the way.
And there's an unknown ship that's being attacked mercilessly. It's holding, but the Defiant is still 4 minutes away. There's no response because they're trying to hail the Klingons. They're trying to hail this ship. Nobody's responding. Dax figures out that the fourth blip is actually a third Klingon ship, but it's just a small patrol. Doesn't have any phasers. They're not really sure what it's doing there. Worf says it's a trap, and he advises them to retreat immediately. And he believes that the people on board that distress call ship are dead already. When suddenly there's an EMP-like pulse that goes off, blinding flashes of light. The Defiant is scrambled for a minute or so. The unidentified ship is now dark, mangled, twisted, kind of blown out of, it's been attacked. The small Klingon ship is gone. And somehow Dr. Bashir got on the bridge and nobody's really sure how. So that was like, what?
Transporter?
The other two ships, the other two Klingon ships are headed back to the wormhole. The Defiant can't catch them because they're temporarily offline. And they say, well, let's go on impulse and go and inspect the dead ship. It's all blown apart. There's no environment. There's no actual interior. It's twisted and mangled. So they have to put on their EVA suits. So Bashir, Worf, Dax, and Sisko do this. Apparently leaving the two ensigns in charge of the ship. The Defiant. Sure. They say, yeah, the ship is unstable, so they've got to set up this force field to hold it together while they continue their searches. This is, of course, Dr. Bashir's first EVA. He feels sick. He's quite a mess. But he requests to be untethered from the others because they're all tied together, almost like a kindergarten with the string. When the kindergartners go on a field trip and you have to hang onto the string, that's what I imagined they were all tied together with. And he says, I got to get untethered so I could do a full DNA scan for the rest of the ship because Dax asked for it. Well, he goes scanning around and he finds it. He says, these beings were vaporized. All I pick up is trace elements of like spray on the walls. They're salsa stains. Worf suspects that there may be a new Klingon weapon that he heard about. Fine time to bring that up, Worf.
Yeah.
So he tells a story about kind of like a kamikaze Klingon suicide bomber. He tells a story about Reynarg. He was this suicide bomber who tried to kill Kales. He got all his generals, but not Kales. And there's a new weapon by the same name, which is designed to detonate and transport over a bomb to another ship, leaving the crew no time to react. They can get through the shields. Like, that sounds like fun. It's like, surprise, so, here's something, boom!
Wait a minute, I'm confused. So how does it work again?
He's telling the story of the rumors he's heard about. The Klingons have a bomb.
Okay.
That they can somehow transport over to another ship, even if the other ship has their shields up.
Okay.
And it's set to detonate pretty much as soon as it materializes, leaving the people no time to beam it away. Okay. So somehow the Klingons have figured out a way to transport this through the shields. Sisko can't understand why the Klingons would use this new weapon right out in front of DS9. So one of my early observations is the author has captured the characters well, because that's something that you would think Sisko would do. He's like, hey, wait a minute. He's a deep thinker and he's trying to think of the strategy. So why would they do this out in front of DS9? And Dax adds, they would have blown up like a galaxy class starship or something. And Bashir says, well, they had to destroy something more valuable to them, something more valuable than exposing their new weapon. So they spread out and search, and Sisko actually finds the infirmary, but it's pretty much cordoned in on itself. It's about the size of a closet at this point. But he finds a Lavanian log. So he calls for Bashir, and everybody comes, and Bashir confirms, yep, it's a medical log. It's like, thanks, dude.
Yeah, appreciate it.
It's in very fragile condition, but they do manage to detach it carefully. The Levanian ship, or whatever remains of it, collapses just as the team is beaming and does an emergency beam out, of course, because, you know, you have to have some suspense. Because of the condition of this log, it's so fragile, O'Brien says, let's wait until we get it back to DS9 to analyze it. So they get back there. He works on it for 9 hours and realizes most of it's gone. But the bits they do retrieve indicate the Klingons are training with the Jem'Hadar at Gamma, in the Gamma Quadrant at GK974. So this has major implications because the Jem'Hadar have much better tech. They're winning the war. And, you know, the Federation usually, they're doing to the Federation what the Klingons, Federation usually does to the Klingons. O'Brien thinks that the log was erased before the Klingons blew up the ship. So
it's a fake.
He brings this. You're reading that far into it, are you already? Okay. Miles brings the news up to the senior staff, and Kira and Worf exchange some words over honor and the alliance. O'Brien and Sisko have some ideas, and Odo mentions that the founders have no concept of alliances, only masters and slaves. And while he was linked, he learned that the founders were fascinated by the Klingons. So Sisko tells O'Brien to send a summary message to Fleet Intelligence and work with Worf to get the Defiant ready to go to the Gamma Quadrant. Ooh. Well, they get a quick response from Starfleet. They say, yep, you got to go. So Sisko makes a hard call and says, Worf, you got to stay behind. And Worf is none too happy about that. But I'm leaving you in charge. We are going on an intelligence mission. We're going cloaked. You need to man the castle. You're the best person. Which
Worf,
sets up.
Today is a good day to stay.
Today is a good day for a salad.
Good day to diet. Yes.
You know, he starts grumbling and complaining, but Dax, because they're in this relationship, she barks a few words at Klingon at him, and of course he backs down. You know, yes, dear. This was rather comical in my mind as I was visualing this. You know, chock, chock, mah, flah. Like, okay, honey, I'll stay home.
I can't believe you use language like that.
But she, like Worf, also doesn't believe there's an alliance. She knows the Klingons very well, of course, being friends with them for years. So Sisko, Kira, Dax, Odo, and two ensigns head out on this mission. They take the Defiant. It's 4 days to GK479. Dun, dun, dun. So 2 days later, back on DS9, 2 days have elapsed. We'll do the, like, SpongeBob. 2 days later.
Yeah.
O'Brien is working in the well up in Ops. You know, you can all visualize this. This was the other thing that I thought was good about this author. He gave a very... Because we're familiar with DS9, he didn't have to describe things too much, unless right. It was a scene or a place we haven't been before. But he did enough that you could visualize this very well. I can see O'Brien working in the well. Okay, he
that
says
little space is kind of off to the side in Ops,
yeah,
right?
Kind of down in that hole with all the control panels and whatnot. And he says, "Oh, I think this is kind of creepy, don't you?" And Worf says, "I find it refreshing." Yeah. Miles notices some odd sensor readings now and then when the station is hit by a huge EMP. Sensors are out and the subspace emitter superstructure is sheared off. So they have no way of communicating with anything. They're like, what was it? Was it a meteorite? There were no vessels detected. Maybe it was somebody cloaked. So they're having this discussion of what they think it could be when all of a sudden a Klingon destroyer decloaks. And a spherical object materializes in Ops. Yeah, based on the description earlier, you think, uh-oh. There's a big blinding flash, and Miles O'Brien was hit by a disruptor. He's dazed and confused. He's not, you know, out cold, but he manages to get out. He's crawling towards the turbo lift. He's calling for Worf. Worf, Worf.
He had a good role.
But Worf does not respond to his dog calls.
By the way, he sounds like a little dog.
Worf, right. He's calling for Worf, Worf, Worf. But Worf does not respond. And just as Miles gets to the turbo lift, the Klingons beam in. And they have disruptors, not batleths, which he thinks is very interesting. This is an unusual Klingon attack. And as the lift descends, one of the Klingons goes, "Hey, there's someone on there." And he goes, "Pew, pew, pew," with his disruptor. Only he shoots out the controls and it stops. But Miles somehow like falls out of the thing. And as he's falling, he manages to grab. He's got one arm that's kind of gimpy and one that works. And he reaches out and catches a cable on the way down. So the Klingon keeps shooting at him, pew, pew, pew. But because of what their EMP did to the station or something, there's like this magnetic interference and all the shots that are headed right for him kind of get winged, deflected off like a bad golf shot. So nobody can really hit him. And he manages to crawl into a small access shaft. Now, Worf wakes up and he's in one of Odo's holding cells. And he notices that this general is very familiar looking. It's Malok, his blood brother. He hasn't seen him for more than 2 decades. Malok says he's doing this for the Klingons and Federation. Like, what? Wait, aren't we supposed to be aligning with the Dominion or something? But Malok has ordered his troops not to kill anyone. And Worf realizes this because they're using disruptors. Malok swore to Gowron that Worf would cooperate. That was nice of him to, you know,
yeah, volunteer
speak
him.
Speak for someone else. The plan is we're going to herd the defeated into portable cells. That's how they refer to everybody on DS9. They're defeated. Then they're going to contact the Federation for ships to transport the defeated to Federation space in exchange for recognition that the station is now Klingon. But first, they have to track down O'Brien to prevent a rebellion.
You know, everybody always seems to want Deep Space Nine and instant strategic value, but it's like, it's not really a great place. I mean,
it's always breaking down, apparently.
Well, there's also a copy of it.
Well, Worf thinks about this, but he says, if I don't go along with this, then he's kind of running the show. But if I go along with it, I can control some of it, kind of being a double agent. So he agrees to this as long as Malok explains why he's doing this. And he gets to that late in the book, but he will. Now, Worf is released, and Malok smiled. But Worf had not sworn anything, so it was conditional. He's like, purposely said the right words at the right time, but he didn't make a blood oath or anything. Worf, he's exiting past one of Malok's guards, and he recognizes him. It's Rodek. Rodek, son of Nogra. He finds out Rodek lost his memory in the Cardassian War. Actually, it's Kern. They wiped his memory, if you remember right.
Yeah. Well, they wiped my memory about that.
Because Kern said, you know, I can't handle the, what was it? He can't handle the discommendation, or there was some place I do remember in the storyline where Kern basically was written off. And this shook Worf to the core. He's like, oh man, what am I going to do? I got my real brother here, but he doesn't know he's my real brother. Okay, we cut to Jake, who's on the promenade in his usual people-watching space, but Nog's not there, of course. And he's moping. He's people-watching, but there's no people. When suddenly, a troop of Klingons appears through the promenade, and they're shooting people, and he doesn't know they're disruptors. So he's getting this image the first time. He feels completely helpless because Odo's crew failed to stop them. Then Jake spots Worf leading them. He's still in his Starfleet uniform. He feels he's a traitor. He thinks he's going to die. So he stands up on the railing and he starts shouting at them. He goes, "I don't." He says, "Not that he's afraid to die. It's just he got this strange sense of, well, if I can't beat him, I'm going to yell at him." So he starts shouting at him, and one of he's shouting at Worf, but Worf doesn't hear him over the battle noise. And another Klingon heard him. He looks up and he fires at Jake, and Jake is hanging on for dear life. But if he dies, then, you know, Malok lied. Somebody died, and Worf. So there's a Jeopardy thing going on here. So a high ranking Klingon actually shoots the one who shot at Jake and killed him. Like, whoa.
What? Whoa. What? Oh, Jake.
So, him? Yeah. No. Jake didn't. Jake's hanging on for dear life.
One Klingon killed another Klingon.
Yeah. Klingon killed another Klingon for almost killing Jake.
I got you.
Well, okay. Jake's hanging onto this cable or wire or something. He starts swinging.
That's nice, but I'm about to die here anyway.
He swings over to a catwalk, manages to hook his boot heel on and clamber away. I don't know who is doing what all this while watching the acrobats above, but Jake he gets away into a crawl space via a catwalk. Well, meanwhile, O'Brien has escaped, into that ventilation shaft, and he comes up onto a grate about 10 meters up on the he's way up above on the promenade, and he's looking out onto the promenade from an air vent, so nobody can see him. And he thinks to himself, he's thankful that Keiko and Molly are safe on Bajor at a conference on vertical gardening. I had to put that in my notes just, it was so obscure.
Very randomly specific there.
The comms are being jammed, but he is hell-bent on fixing this all. So he starts descending to the engineering levels, but he realizes he needs help. Okay. Julian, on the other hand, this is his story of how he witnessed all this stuff. He's in the infirmary doing diagnostics on whatever, because there's no patients to treat. Right. But he does have some of his staff with him. He looks up and he sees Klingons overrunning everything. He tries his badge for an emergency med tech beam out, but no luck because comms are down. He discovers the same thing Miles did. He tries to find anything to use as a weapon, but his techs have been so good, they put everything away. <It's> like, curses, no hypo sprays to knock anybody out. And as a Klingon spots Bashir and fires, one of his assistants, in a panic, steps in front and takes the blast.
Wow.
That was an accidental oopsie. So he figures, well, I'm going to fake being hit. So he collapses. Somebody falls on top of him. And all he can think of is, why? Why? The Klingons now drag him and the other bodies out of the promenade. And he discovers that the others are actually alive. But he dare not speak to give himself away. He wants to gain some intel and see. So he learns that everybody's only stunned, and he hears Worf commanding the troops. Well, this adds to the confusion, doesn't it? Worf actually spots Bashir in the heap. So Bashir is like trying to crack open his eyes enough to see what's going on. He sees Worf, and Worf shakes his head imperceptibly and goes back to work. So he's given Julian a signal. He's confused, but he knows that Worf is compelled to help. Again, the Klingons move the bodies somewhere else, this time to a Klingon restaurant. Julian hears some clanking, and
that's not a good sign.
Because the Klingons the Klingons move the bodies and move on. So Julian's just sitting there with a bunch of dozed people, pretending he's dozed, and he hears a bunch of noise. Suddenly O'Brien emerges from one of the vents, and Bashir still doesn't respond. So Miles thinks everybody's been killed. And he starts pouring out his guts over Julian, but he's very clumsy in the way he does it. Oh, I'm sorry, I beat you at darts. It's just really terrible stuff. And then Julian opens his eyes and makes a comment like, "Is that the best you can do?" And Miles just gets so upset. This is a great Julian and Miles scene, in my opinion. He's all upset, like, "Why didn't you tell me?" But after a few minutes of arguing, they reconcile and decide to make their escape back into the air vent from which Miles just emerged. But I loved that scene when I was reading it. I was laughing the whole time.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
This is classic. Back on the Defiant.
Yes, the good old Defiant.
They're like 2 days out at sea, right? And this is when Sisko starts getting suspicious. He says, I have a sneaky suspicion we're not alone. We're cloaked, and we've passed 3 Dominion ships undetected. But Sisko suspects something's not right, and Dax agrees. Odo is nervous. But nobody knows that they're there. So how can they be followed or anything? And then Sisko says, I don't like coincidences. Look, the Klingons destroyed the ship on the Alpha side. Why didn't they destroy it on the Gamma side? The Klingons blew up the ship, but the log, the only piece of valuable intel, remained intact. Someone tried to destroy the log, but the log is completely erased save for the few critical bits. unlike coincidences. So they all start discussing. Odo says, "We have our orders." And Kira says, "Oh, come on, you're going on about a conspiracy? This is far-fetched." Sisko orders Dax to do sensor sweeps for warp trails on the Gamma side. Even though this incident took place 2 days ago, maybe they can pick up some warp trails. They're finding none, but they realize that things were staged. So they kind of coasted up to the wormhole and then turned on their warp engines when they got there or something. They also reconsidered the DNA that they found. And they said the explosion was in the back of the ship. So the damage should have been less. And it was all vaporized. There should have been at least body parts found on this thing. And all they found was this mist. So they feel like what they call they've been chasing a green puffin, which is somebody's attempt at making a red herring. And they even had to explain.
I thought you meant MacGuffin.
No, it's a green puffin. So you can all now right. start using that, Star Trek fans. They had to make a choice. Do they continue to Gamma GK-947 or turn back? And after a lot of discussion back and forth that I'm not going to get into, they decide, of course, to turn around when they get a collision warning. Yep, they were being followed.
Yeah.
They were being tailgated, it sounds like.
Yeah, too right. close. Step on the brakes. Bam.
Full reverse.
So we now have two cloaked ships, the Defiant and some mystery ship. They can't raise their shields until the cloak is dropped, which takes 5 seconds, which would give the other ship a chance to fire on them. So Kira starts delicately working the sensors to search for a ship. Back to DS9. O'Brien is disagreeing with Julia's idea to bring in Garak, because Garak is still around. But Julian says, look, he's a spy. He knows this stuff. He's good at it. He'll be able to help us out.
Not a spy, he's a tailor.
Back and forth, yeah. Back and forth. Julian finally pulls rank for one of the few times that I recall on O'Brien and gives Miles an order. So, bring in Quark. Quark was in the bar with Morn and a retired Bajoran judge when Rom bursts in, causing Quark to spill drinks all over Morn, which I think would have been visually funny. He says, yeah, we benefited. He says, we benefited by Klingons. We benefited by Klingons. Quark isn't listening, and Rom takes him by the lapels and shakes him, which, again, visually funny, in my opinion, would have been great to see.
Yeah.
They start, you know, Quark is going, what are you babbling on about when they see Klingons shooting at people in the promenade? Quark comes to his senses, of course. Rom starts to say, I want. And Quark says, stop. Do not say it. You know what he's about to say, right? I want Moogie.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. No. I saw that. I kind of saw that coming, but I wasn't sure.
It was right there as I was reading. It's like, please, please, please. Oh, Quark shuts him down. So they bolt the door shut with a new deadbolt that Quark recently installed. He said the one that was there could have been cut through in 5 seconds by, you know, a phaser. It turns out the new and improved one took 20 seconds. It's like, but it did give them enough time to do some stuff. Rom is unloading the safe and Quark pauses. He goes, wait, how did you get the safe open? And Rom says, oh, I pick your lock every couple of days in case of emergency. So Quark has two phaser rifles hidden under the register. He tosses one to Rom, who fumbles and drops it.
Sure.
And then they discover quickly that the batteries on both are missing. This is just it gets even funnier. Well, you gotta have a power pack.
Is Morn still there, like shaking his head?
I don't know where Morn is. He's probably sitting there getting blasted by a phaser.
Or I was gonna say, is this like one of his product placement things, like with the Amex and stuff, where they open it up and the Duracell's in there?
No, it did not. It was not that blatant. So Rom and Quark imagine to escape through what they call a bolt hole. This is an unwritten plan for an escape hatch. Just as the Klingons burst in, I think it was tied to one of the rules of acquisition, but I'm not sure. You know, I always have an escape plan or something. Just as the Klingons burst in and jump the bar, So the Klingon tries to make a grab for Quark, who went in second into the tunnel, but he didn't get him. He's like, he got his heel. Quark kicks a couple of times and gets free. I think he took a couple of shots down the hole, but they'd already turned and disappeared. Rom suggests to Quark, we should find Chief O'Brien. And Quark wants to get off the station as soon as possible. Let's head towards the cargo bay. So Rom, being Rom, concedes. Yeah, Quark's the older brother. He gets the rules. Okay, back to Miles. He's hurt and crawling through the tunnels with Julian, but he doesn't want to let Julian know how badly he's hurt. Julian asks loads of questions, as he does, and Miles...
Does whoever you do this? No.
I wonder what they're doing for... What are the Klingons... And Miles politely asks him to shut up, as he does. Again, great character combinations in this. They get to Garak's shop, but Julian says he won't be here. So instead, he's hoping to find a clue, some kind of note. They have a discussion about how that would work if the attack was quick. So they made it to Garak's shop. It's been ransacked. They fall out of this tunnel. Bashir goes first, a little more gracefully than Miles, because Miles is hurt and also heavier. And they made some comment about, you know, how I wish I were lean and mean like Julian, but I'm not going to tell him that. Julian starts looking for clues while Miles checks around the front entrance. He walks towards the door and realizes that the auto open on the door failed, and he walked right into it, breaking his nose. So Julian had to repair that too. O'Brien is able to force the doors open to the promenade.
Because it's not Deep Space Nine unless Miles O'Brien suffers.
Right. And he suffers a lot in this thing. He manages to force the doors open to the promenade, but there's no body and there's no blood. But he does hear talk about portable cells that you know, Julian told him he heard about. So they go back to searching for possible messages from Garak. O'Brien spots some symbols on the wall. It's a chemistry diagram for a Cardassian amino acid called Corrigan 9-5. And O'Brien suggests that Klingons lack a sense of humor, whereas Cardassians revel in that kind of stuff. They would hide the clue in a joke or a riddle or a pun. So Julian, I think, figured out that Corrigan is an anagram for cargo. Ah, which cargo bay? And then Julian realizes, well, that he said 9-5. 9 minus 5 is 4. He's in cargo 4, which is Corrigan 9-5. In cargo 4. So right. That's where they head. Back on the Defiant. The Defiant is moving very slowly. They can't warp, or the other ship will detect their warp trail. Dax detects something close. Odo suggests, why don't we light a torch, but don't be near it? So Dax says it won't work, but Kira jumps in. And there's Sisko knows that they're planning something. They're up to something. They've got to figure it out. There's a discussion / techno babble about pulses and waves and whatnot. And while Dax and Kira work out whatever pulse to detect the cloaked ship, Sisko and Ensign Wheeler pulse the engines in random directions to keep the Klingons on their toes. They send out a pulse, take 10 seconds to recharge, and while that happens, they lock weapons. Then 3 seconds for shields. The hyperphasic pulse was very powerful. And Kira is looking for the other ship. She finds something and sends it directly to Dax. Dax detects it and sends the coordinates to Kira. The phasers are charging. Kira fires. And the Defiant is hit. The Klingons fired torpedoes, but they also raised their shields. So the Defiant's shields happened to hold. The Klingon weapons were taken. The Klingons' weapons were taken out by the Defiant's first shot. They head back towards the wormhole with the damaged Bird of Prey in hot pursuit. Now it's a race. Sisko has Kira take the helm from Ensign Wheeler. And she's like, why? You know, I got all straight A's in Starfleet Academy for navigation and whatnot. And there's a discussion about navigation, relativity, and how Starfleet only teaches students what they need to know. It's a great quote. Navigation is not science. It's an art. So Sisko, of course, throws in a baseball analogy.
Oh, Tom Paris is in this one?
No.
Okay.
Dax says, hey, the Klingons are gaining on them. They're in overdrive. They're running hotter than their engines should. So Kira reminds them that they don't have any weapons. Well, what are they going to do? Well, they're planning to ram them, of course.
Ramming speed.
Yeah, pretty much. Sisko tells Dax to do what you can. Get more speed without burning out the engines. Just make sure you slow the closure of this distance. Well, they need to get power from either the shields or the phasers. So Sisko says, I choose the phasers. Which doesn't make sense because the other ship doesn't have phasers. So why wouldn't you take it from the shields? You don't need shields at this point. I think they made a bad choice.
Right.
The bird of prey starts falling behind because they got a little more juice. Well, that only lasts for a little while. The bird of prey pushes their engines even harder. This battle goes back and forth for 8 hours. Fortunately, I didn't have to read all of that.
For 18 pages.
The Klingons would close to almost nothing, and then their ship is so hot that they have to, back off. So Sisko suggests, why don't we drop a few photon torpedoes every few minutes, like as mines? Maybe they'll hit one. Well, they did hit one and became weary, so they backed off. But still, they keep on coming and not blowing up, even though they should have. So the tension is growing. Kira asks about the Klingon speed versus their temperature. So they drop the last four torpedoes. The Klingons slow down. The Defiant gets 11 light seconds ahead. Very specific number they quoted. 11 light seconds. The Klingons are pursuing one more time and blow up. So they're clear to the wormhole. Whew. Solve that problem just by outrunning them. Back on the station, Jake is still sneaking around the ship, avoiding Klingons and wandering aimlessly when he finds himself in Cargo Bay 4. He's trying to think of a plan to steal a roundabout and get to Bajor and warn his dad. He tries the restricted code to get into Cargo Bay 4 that he got from his dad. Dad gave him some things to survive, but nothing works. So he resorts to some skills he learned from Nog. He basically creates a jam bar that goes up and over the door and triggers the inside sensors. Door's open, no problem. When he hears some voices, Ferengi voices, Jake startles them, which here's another great Rom and Quark. Quark is like, take Rom. It was his idea. And Rom says, I'd be happy to inform on my brother.
Right.
They're both throwing each other under the bus at this point. So because they don't know it's Jake. So he steps out and asks about a runabout, and they both say, nope, we already thought of that. There's no runabout here. All three are then surprised by another. Jake doesn't know who it is. He strikes out, and he manages to hit Garak. They didn't know Garak was there. Remember Jake, his message, I'm in Cargo Bay 4? Well, Jake didn't get the memo. He welcomes the newcomer. Now they got four. Quark is actually more sarcastic. He's not as convinced that Garrick's there to help. He doesn't trust Garak.
Right.
But they share info and they start making a map on the floor of the station with Garrick's Taylor's chalk on the floor. Rom asks about Worf, and he doesn't know at this point that, Worf is, where's Worf? He's leading the troops. He's a traitor. Not everybody's convinced. And Garak tells him, Worf, your friend, is actually leading the forces. So he's forced to admit what he already saw. Worf is a traitor. Then Garak produces something that he claims is a weapon. It's a communicator, only everything's encrypted. They could use it as a weapon. Garak goes on to tell how he acquired this. I'm not going to get into all that because he makes this grandiose story, which may or may not be true. And he says, I wish Dr. Bashir could have witnessed it. How he took out a Klingon single-handedly, which he may have been able to. I don't know. So Miles and Julian are on their way to Cargo Bay 4 to join the others. They're making their way across a catwalk in a turbolift shaft, when Julian asks, what happens if a turbolift comes by? Miles goes, relax. No, it won't happen. And sure enough, one comes by.
Yeah. Boom.
They go into the whole teeth rattling experience in gory detail as the lift goes by. And apparently, if you hold still, the lighting is such that they won't see you. But Miles lifts his head a little too soon and is detected. A Klingon managed to get off one shot. He fires and misses, and they go, we got to get out of here before they come back. So they have to think of some place to go and return, but there's not much place. And Julian says, Miles, how tightly do the shields fit against the station? And they realize there are gaps. There's like this little buffer between where the shield is. There's like half a meter. So they manage to get through an open maintenance port and they find a ledge. They're outside. They step outside this maintenance port on a ledge on the station.
Right.
Between the hull of the ship and a shield. So they still have air, but they're in space without any suits. Kind of freaky.
And they're gonna sign that one, the oldest plate on the outside of the deep space.
Yeah, so like, Kilroy. I think I've heard this one before.
Kilroy was here. Miles then discovers that Worf he looks outside, he takes a glance back inside the port, and he sees Worf is leading, and he doesn't believe it. And he figures something's up. I know Worf. I've known Worf for a long time. But he isn't sure if Worf saw him, because there was no indication. Worf does a very good job with his, I saw this, but don't tell anybody. In fact, he did see them, and he tells the other two Klingons that he's with, nothing here.
Nothing here.
Miles then tells Julian what he saw, and Julian agrees there must be an explanation for what Worf is up to while trying to convince Miles, because they're both kind of, I saw it, but I don't believe it. Is it happening? He says, maybe Worf is setting some kind of trap. Actually, my notes didn't even say some kind of, that just slipped out because it's Star Trek.
It's Trek. It's allowed.
Yeah.
Right.
They realize they need to get a move on to Cargo Bay 4. Time's a-wasted. So they both realize that the assault was mild for the Klingons because they're only using disruptors, blah, blah, blah. They try to get into a nearby weapons locker. It won't open when suddenly, pew, 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 someone's firing at them. Again, Miles is hit, minorly.
How the man isn't dead, we don't know.
They both get away somehow, again, through bad shots and whatnot. And they continue through this maze of passageways and corridors and air vents till they get to Cargo Bay 4.
And most of Miles is there at the same
time. Don't worry, I'm getting it's getting to right? the conclusion pretty quickly. Because I'm going, where's the vengeance in any of this? most of the book I'm going, it's called Vengeance, right? I keep flipping to the front cover.
Where's the name of a ship?
In Cargo Bay 4, Jake is guarding the front door while Rahm and Quark bicker, as they do. He's so involved in listening to them, he nearly misses a nearby noise in the ventilation shaft that, of course, turns out to be O'Brien and Bashir. After they exit, Garak says, ah, I see you two got my message. Jake says they haven't seen any other survivors, and Julian lets him know that the others are not dead. They confirm that they saw what they saw Worf doing, and Bashir and Garak do a little dance around leadership. They're trying to push it off on each other. Garak, you're a member of the Obsidian Order, former member of the Obsidian Order. Dr. Bashir, you are the ranking Federation official, and this is a Federation station, blah, 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 blah. Finally, it ends up on Julian, and he says, do we have any weapons? Quark says, I had a phaser rifle, but it was drained, and Jake has a club. Yes. I don't know where he got the club, but I thought that was funny too. Rahm shows O'Brien the encrypted comm link that Garak showed them earlier. He could do something. O'Brien says, I could do something if both my hands worked. So Rahm, you're going to have to be my hands and we'll fix it together. So that was a nice little team up that you could see happening. Jake at this point is like going into shutdown mode. He's so overwhelmed that he imagines himself at Grandpa's restaurant trying to put reality into a story. So that's a nice way of removing yourself from someplace. Rahm and O'Brien do manage to get the comm link working. Jake suggests that they use their comms to track where they are. So since it's Jake's suggestion, he puts him on it. He says, you're in charge of that now. You made this. But this is kind of how this story goes too. If you make a suggestion, you're in charge of executing that. So Jake says, we should use the comm link to track where they are. Good suggestion. Why don't you get right on that? O'Brien makes a comment about wanting to know what Worf is up to, and Garak retorts about never trusting Klingons. And O'Brien just goes off on him, starting to defend Worf. And this is kind of like where you go, oh, yep, yep. He doesn't believe he's a traitor either. Garrick then says, the human capacity for wishful thinking never ceases to amaze me. Meanwhile, Jake is still listening intently to the comms, and he says, the Klingons, they're headed this way. Their only option is a dead-end storage locker. So they all file in there, and as the Klingons enter the cargo bay, the room is dark, so they use their tricorders to start scanning around, and I guess they're inside this locker with slots in it, because somehow they see the Klingons scanning in their direction.
And they're in, like, high school lockers.
But very deep, very deep. They can all fit in there. They can all fit in there. Dr. Bashir hears a faint noise, and he turns to see an amber light behind him, and Garrick has something. Oddly enough, the Klingons don't detect any life forms. Ah, Garrick's had some secret device to disable their tricorders.
Just a sewing needle, nothing important.
So Klingons go away, they file out, and Bashir confronts him. He says, what was that? What was what, doctor? Complete ignorance. It was another great Bashir Garrick moment. They do need to stay put, and they need to make a plan. So they talk about, can we send a probe and maybe send a message? Nope. Got to get past the shields that the Klingons basically sheared off the communications array. So they have no way of communicating unless they can get out past their shields. So, Jake discovers from the comms that, again, I have to interpret my notes here. Discovers from the comms that Worf is actually leading the Klingons in circles. He's not being an effective leader by Klingon means, but he's giving them opportunities. And that's, Jake says, okay, he's on our side. The team discusses, they discuss some options to get a message to Worf. And they said, you know, he's been around humans a long time. What if we, Klingons are not prone to a sense of humor, but Worf might get it if we encrypt it in a pun. So Jake says, we should turn off the environmental controls, blow out the atmosphere. And that ought to slow the Klingons down.
Well, and Worf too.
No.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. It was Rom's idea. Maybe we should turn off the environmental controls. That ought to slow down the Klingons. Yeah. Good suggestion, Rom. When Quark says, won't that also leave us dead too? And what about the prisoners? You know, they don't have pressure suits. They need a level 4 force field to protect them, and it's probably not on the agenda today. So Jake says, send the message now so we don't have to dump the air until later. So they come up with this, and suddenly Jake feels important because words are his thing. He's going to craft this message. So he crafts up the message, and he sends it along this comm link. Everybody hears it, including Malik. So Worf is running, or he's now Colonel Worf. He's got his troops searching around places repeatedly. And if anybody goes, hey, we've already searched here, he goes, are you challenging my authority?
Yeah.
Which almost sounds like, you will respect my authority.
So, yeah. Are you challenging me to a duel?
General Malik is starting to get suspicious. And he gets this message that Jake sent. And he says, hey, everybody, cut the chatter. We're you know, there's a missing comm link out there somewhere, so please be quiet. And Worf suspects, of course, that it came from O'Brien because of the context of what it said. Then we get another voice that says, General, I don't understand the gravity of the situation. And Worf takes note of that. So Malik scolds whoever it is for not using the proper frequency. Worf figures it out, but how to get them a message back. So he intentionally sends a message to everyone with a similar hidden words. And Malik scolds him too. Like, clearly Malik has no control over who's communicating on what. Like, hey, I said cut the chatter. I said cut the chatter.
He said cut the chatter.
This is John Smith here. Yeah.
Did you hear the one about the Klingon Ferengi and Cardassian walk into a bar?
Oh, boy.
So Worf tells the prison guards to increase the force fields. He's figured out what's going to happen. But Malik is smart, and he suspects something's up. And Worf now has his troops marching to the opposite end of the habitat ring, and he sends one of his majors to Malik with a message. So he didn't go over the comm system. He says, tell him the weight of our assault should focus on the habitat ring, where we have left too much of a force vacuum.
Wow. Subtlety, that name is Klingon.
Make sure you get that clearly there, buddy. Repeat it back to me so I make sure you got it.
And be sure you say it in all caps when you get to those words.
And he did this while activating the Major's comlink on his helmet so O'Brien could hear it. So Malik figures Worf is up to something.
More of a party line than it is a communications.
Yeah, he finally, that's what I was thinking, actually.
He finally orders radio silence for broadcast messages. I guess by penalty of death, I don't know.
Deep Space Nine now concludes its broadcast day.
Malik tries to talk to Worf into loyalty to the Klingon Empire, and Worf actually considers it briefly. Then he realizes, of course, that Klingons cannot survive in a Dominion realm. So, Jake and Miles believe Worf got the message. We hope. Julian's not so sure. It was a huge risk, and he finally agrees that they to make their move. They need to get to the environmental controls without running into Worf. So maybe they use some access tunnels? And Miles warns of the safety of doing so because it's small and cramped and hot and all kinds of nasty stuff. But they all agree to climb four levels up on a ladder.
The Star Trek V solution.
It's hot, confined, dark in the tunnels, but they just made
get the
it.
Boots, the gravity boots, anti-gravity boots.
The lights are out, and Garrick makes a comment about the Federation not maintaining lights. And O'Brien says, "Nobody uses this tunnel." And Rom says, "It's the next thing on my list. If you want to take a list, I'll show it to you." And Mal says, "Don't show him. It's none of his business. The Obsidian Order doesn't need to know how we maintain this station." I was just again, the character's coming alive.
They're the one who left it in this shape to begin with.
Worf, Rom being Rom and O'Brien being O'Brien, it was just fun to read. So at this point, Jake is now getting really anxious and even fearful because it's 42 meters to the bottom, but he's not afraid of falling. He's afraid of failing. He doesn't want to let these people down because his dad's the captain and he's supposed to have this perceived image. And the rungs on this ladder are really wide spaced, and Rom almost has to hop from one to the other. Miles gets a little bit of head and he finally stops at a hatch. The rest happen to catch up. And
does he bang his head on that hatch as well?
Julian thinks he's afraid of falling. So he's talking to Jake, and after a bunch of back and forth, Jake finally manages to clear the gap from the ladder to this open hatch. And he follows Miles and Rom down the tunnel. They all go down the tunnel. They get to a corridor, of course, filled with Klingons, and they need to cross this Klingon. So silently, Bashir signals Rom and Quark to listen for footsteps. And just as Miles, Quark, and Julian step out from behind the grate, a door opens and a Klingon appears. Shh, shh. Oh, wait, that's not the sound on DS9, is it? It's...
clunk. They're very mechanical.
At first, the Klingon walks through the door. He just dumbstruck for a second, stares, blinks, and then he starts reacting with the disruptors. But Garrick jumps out and he makes the first strike and knocks out a couple in the process. So he takes down a few Klingons. And it's like, wow, maybe Garrick is really the way to go. As they get up, the gang is 15 meters down the corridor and the Klingons are firing under Worf's command. So Worf is in this group. And as more troops arrive, it's getting like congested and they can't really aim effectively and actually end up hitting Worf, causing all kinds of mayhem. But that was all to plan. Worf meant to be hit to cause this mayhem and let them get away. So again, Worf being very clever about hiding his true intentions. All right, now we get to, I think I'm on the last, penultimate page, and it goes quicker from here. I'm not as detailed because I stopped making detailed notes, and now I'm going from memory from a couple of weeks ago. The team makes their way to the environmental controls. They find some EV suits. One is actually Cardassian, and that, of course, goes to Garrick. The rest are Federation, which do not fit Rom and Quark. They are comically swimming in these things. They have no controls of their hands or feet, and they can barely see out of the helmet. So that I would love to see visually as well. So our team of resistance fighters manages to turn off the environmental controls and vent all the air. Well, that addresses about 90% of the Klingons, but many have found suits on their own. The Defiant, in the meantime, has made its way back to the station under cloak. And another Klingon ship is pursuing them because there's one that's been hanging around the station. They do some battle, lots of details. They manage to disable them after doing this close battle range by the station. And the Defiant team discovers that the comms array is missing and the atmosphere is vented. Imagine Sisko's reaction. What have you done to my station?
I leave for 2 days, and this is what I come back to.
I can't. That's it. No more vacations.
I leave you alone for 10 minutes.
And they wanted me to go to Risa for a week. our resistance team needs to send a message out beyond the shields, but they can't because, of course, the Klingon shields. And after some discussion, Quark suggests that someone needs to go out there. And as I said before, if it's your idea, it's your plan. He gets volunteered. So they stuff him in this oversized, well, he's already stuffed into the oversized suit. They stuff him into an airlock and shoot him out. he avoids missing a pylon and the disabled ship. All the while, Quark is going, I hate the suggestion. I hate my own suggestion. Along the way, they encounter and get past several more Klingons because they shot Quark out, but they got to get past him because they still have to get to environmental control and fix everything up. So they discover, of course, that the captives are okay. Thank goodness the level 4 force field held, that somebody actually Worf managed to turn it on. At this point, Malik sends for Worf, and they have a confrontation. Which is when the title of the book is finally revealed as Malik's Vengeance, which I felt was really weak. It was so weak, I don't even remember the details of it, but it had something to do with Worf and when they were young. So he's all ticked off like 20 years later for something Worf did. Like, yeah, all right, whatever. that was the weakest part of the whole story, in my opinion.
Well, then why would he want him on his side?
To try and reclaim him?
Because he's got vengeance?
He's a blood brother. Yeah. I don't know. That was the confusing part. If I had time this afternoon, I would have reread it, but I ran out. So meanwhile, Quark gets out past the shields and manages to send a message. I don't know how. He didn't take any kind of communications device unless he's yelling into his helmet.
He just flashed the mirror.
Right. Bounce the sun off of your mirror towards Bajor. The Defiant crew, or at least Dax anyway, manages to beam aboard the station, and I believe she's the one who killed Malik. I don't remember. It wasn't terribly... they restore the environment. The captives are free. Quark's message is received by a transport ship, and it appears right behind him, but he doesn't know. Meanwhile, Odo had picked up on Quark's comms, and Quark has been out there for... like close to all the time left in his air. So he's running out of air. And he's going, please, somebody save me. And then, of course, Odo jumps in and goes, what would it take to save you? And they have this back and forth Odo Quark exchange again, which I thought was memorable, but I didn't write it down. And that's pretty much, it ends on that comedic note of Odo getting the upper hand over Quark. Now, my notes overall, I pretty much stated this. I overall enjoyed this. I'd give it a 7 out of 10, just from the storyline, the visualizations. The author captured the characters well. The situation was plausible for a DS9 situation in that time. And like I said, the scenes were very easy to visualize.
So let me ask you, since this is fresher in your mind.
Yes.
Than when I was asking Craig about this. Did you have any places where, because you had some red shirts with you on the
Defiant. Oh, the ensigns on the Defiant, yeah.
Yeah, did you feel at any point that there was any real danger?
To the Defiant? Yes.
To anyone? Like,
yes.
Were issues solved very quickly, like a confrontation was...
No. When they got into a battle, the battles lasted. They had to think of ways to, like, hey, we're both cloaked. We can't raise our shields or fire or anything. They went through the details pretty good about that. And being pursued relentlessly by some fanatical Klingon in a bird of prey, willing to blow up his own ship in the pursuit of the Defiant. I thought that was pretty gripping. I thought that when the crew on DS9, Miles and Julian and Garrick, etc., when they ran into the Klingons, they kind of got through them a little easily. I mean, these are warriors. They should know how to fire a disruptor in the right direction. Now, of course, one of those situations,
just main cast being a scene.
Right. And one of those situations was, of course, confounded by Worf. But it seemed a little too easy for them to get past the Klingons multiple times.
Right. So there was no like character introduced in, say, the first, because, you know, one way you can add, I would think, some of the
kill the ensigns.
Well, not kill the ensigns, but you have the ensign doing something throughout, and you just kind of start to incorporate him as always one of the cast, blah, 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 and all of a sudden, boom,
yeah,
he's gone.
You start caring for that character, and then none of that.
Yeah, my, I'm just curious, you know, whether or not you felt like it played out like an episode would play out or like a dark episode would play out.
Like an episode. It was not all that dark.
Okay. All right. So overall, not too bad though. Rating 7.
No, it was fun. It was a fun read, and it was easy read too. I found it very fast.
That's good for you then.
Well, perfect. Quark doesn't agree. I mean, Odo doesn't agree.
Worf.
Yeah.
I'll take my little wicker basket.
They did do a number of, you know, characterizations like that. Things that you would expect the character to do. Yeah. And Odo responds with his usual oomph.
Yeah.
But this, I mean, that is one of the shorthands. That's one of the advantages of, as you said, knowing the characters, the locations, all that stuff ahead of time. You can shorthand that and put in those little things.
Little details.
That they usually do.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
To make you go, ah, yes, that's, you know, that's that character.
Yeah. Or, you know, Worf and Rom. I'd take him. It was his plan. I'd be happy to snitch on my brother.
Take my brother, please.
Those moments made the book for me. If it weren't for those, it would be a drag.
All right. Well, that's it for our book reviews until we get our next new batch of books. Looking at you, Mr. Steph.
In about 6 months.
Yeah.
Although we could, you know, mail these around so we could each read them again.
Yes, we can do that, but you know, we won't review them a second time.
Did all I was the last of three?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We're done.
Yes, Craig went first, but it was a while between Craig's and mine, which is when I was asking him the question about, you know, the feel of it. It had been longer, so he didn't have his
I apologize to the listeners if that was a little long. I know we went into some great detail on some of that stuff.
Wait, where's our apology?
Yeah.
You are were you not listening?
Oh, I'm contractually obligated to be
saying?
Here.
Sorry, what? If
you just admitted you weren't listening. I included the listeners.
No, I know. I just said, where's our apology?
Which implies you weren't listening. You weren't included in the listeners that I addressed.
Stop it with your stupid logic.
We're here all week, people. We're here all week. speaking of which, we'll be back in 2 weeks, and in 2 weeks will be the premiere for the season 5 and final season of Discovery. Although I don't think we're going to get any hints that it's the end of Discovery in these first 9 episodes, because it sounds like everything's tacked on in the final episode. But they will be premiering episode 1 and episode 2, both on April 4th. Just to confound us, and we will be discussing both of those episodes.
It's going to be hard to take notes on two shows at once.
Yeah, it's going to be more general impression, I think, than anything with them.
And random guesswork of where do you think this storyline is going to go?
And I don't think that they've gone episodic with it. So, we'll be able to flow from one episode to the next without, you know, bounce back and forth without any problem on that.
Right.
So we have that to look forward to. Maybe in 2 weeks, Paramount will be sold. Maybe it won't be. Maybe someone else is going to come in and make an offer. It's always interesting.
I kind of hope it stays intact.
I do too.
Yeah.
I just would really like this to be settled, because as much as there's that plan we talked about for stuff with Paramount, make no mistake about it, people are very shy about pulling the trigger on a project when you've got this kind of chaos going on. That's not just from people internally. It's from somebody you want to hire to be in something. And they go, well, if you're going to pay me whether or not you actually do this, sure. But right now you're a dumpster fire and I need to, you know, so it really needs to get settled sooner rather than later. Fingers crossed. All right. Well, it's about time to refill the dilithium chamber and to warp on out of here. So you can find me, Clinton, over at comedyforecast.com, all one word with the number 4. And I just put out an episode last week. You can go check that. It's a Heartstopper episode with Doggone Murder. So you get to solve a crime before Detective Hart. Long before
Heartstopper. Ah, two A's, two T's. Spell it right, say it right.
And yeah, who speaks for you guys?
Go ahead, Chuck.
I speak for our guys. You can find Craig and me at Technorama Podcast over at chuckchat.com, or search for Technorama Podcast anywhere. We cover all kinds of nerdy news and crazy history stuff. There's a lot of, you might learn something, but it's not our fault.
We got some robot news coming up.
And that's a good slogan. You might learn something, but that's not our fault. Yeah.
Not our fault. Yeah. We didn't contribute to that. I think
Craig coined that one years ago.
No, I think so.
All right. Well, with that said, we'll see you on April 4th if you're going to catch us live. And if not, the episode should be out on April 5th, where we talk about episode 1 and episode 2 of season 5 of Discovery.
April the 4th be with you.
Time to hit the theme, boys.
Isn't April 5th First Contact? No, not First Contact Day. Picard Day.
I don't know. I leave the little character of Picard.
Isn't April 5th? Anyway.
So, if you like the show and you know when Picard Day is, then be sure to tell a friend about it and subscribe so you never miss an episode. We'd love to hear from you. Follow us on X at The Topic is Trek. Visit our Facebook page or visit thetopicistrek.com. Until next time, on behalf of Chuck, Craig, and myself, I'm Clinton, thanking you for listening. And as we always say here on The Topic is Trek,
don't put on the red shirt.
No.
It's on June 16th.
So April 5th is on June 16th? I'm confused.
Yes.